Welcome to the Money Maze podcast. I'm Simon Brewer, and along with my co-founder, Will Campion, we created this show in 2020 to explore and unravel some of the mysteries surrounding the investment and business worlds. Episodes are available on audio via most podcast platforms and on video via our YouTube channel. And we're active on all major social media platforms. To stay up to date with every episode, please do sign up to our newsletter at moneymazepodcast.com. And we'd like to thank you for listening. If we could ask one favour, we'd love you to tell a friend or colleague about us. Thank you. Our guest today has published more than 100 academic papers and co-authored several books. His firm research affiliates manage circa $150 billion in assets, and he's earned a reputation as a highly respected, value-oriented investor with clarity about unrealistic valuations, mean reversion, and where the opportunities lie. Perfect for today's highly skewed, AI-obsessed, passive-besotted investing world. Rob Arnott, welcome to the Money Maze podcast.
Thank you very much.
Am I right in saying you've just landed from the US?
That's almost exactly right. It was about 6 hours ago.
Oh, and you live in Miami or?
I live in Miami except in summer. This is my transition week. I flew from Miami here and I fly back to California after. So I spend summers in California.
Well, as I started my research, and I've known your name around, and as we said before we started recording, I knew you were at the great Salomon Brothers with Henry Kaufman back in the late 80s. I see you studied at the University of California, Santa Barbara, where you studied economics, applied mathematics, and computer science. Now, it turns out we've had another guest who was at the University of California in Santa Barbara, which was Christopher Ailman, the CIO of Culster's until the 1st of July. But I presume you know him.
I know him. He's terrific. Great thinker, too.
Great. Well, the question that struck me was markets or mathematics? Growing up, which grabbed you first?
Oh, mathematics, but it's a close call. In high school, I was kind of toying with going into astrophysics or into finance. And I realized, probably my first year of college, that astrophysics is pure high math, higher math. And I was always very good at math, but not world class. And if you're merely very good at math, you're going to be a very ordinary astrophysicist. So I decided finance has always interested me. And in finance, scientific method wasn't used back then. So it was a great opportunity.
And how do you develop those quantitative skills that have led you to the disciplines that are so central to your work?
Oh, the quantitative skills that are used in finance are actually pretty straightforward. You don't need differential equations. You don't need string theory. So really, arcane math is utterly unnecessary. But being good at math helps. And being big picture helps. I think the quant community has gotten itself besotted with the notion of dive into history, find the relationships that appear in history, concoct a story for why this should work after you've already identified that it worked, and then presume that it'll work in the future. That's not scientific method. And so the quant community today, I think, is not that much closer to scientific method than the old rule of thumb investors of the 40s and 50s.
Got it. So as you develop your investment skills, there is a divergence where some investors move towards a growth camp and some sit in a value camp. And those of us who are valuation, I won't say obsessed, valuation focused, are a smaller group of people perhaps than was once the case.
How of value managers have gone out of business.
I'm just interested in how you acquired those skills or why you decided that that particular part of the investment sphere was the one you wanted to occupy.
The growth side of the market, to do well in growth, you have to do deep dives and understand the individual companies and their prospects, and understand it better than all the other analysts out there. which is a tough hurdle. To do well in value, you have to be disciplined, contrarian, and bet on long horizon mean reversion. That's easy. It's actually surprisingly easy. So when we invented fundamental index back in 2004, one of the elements of fundamental index is that it rebalances the portfolio quarterly and trims whatever stock has gotten ahead of its fundamentals. Stocks that have gone up and their fundamentals haven't, the narrative is this company's doing great things. The earnings are going to catch up. Don't you worry. And narratives have the advantage of being often true, and the huge disadvantage of already being entirely reflected in the share price. So in order for that stock that soared where its fundamentals have lagged, in order for it to outperform, it has to exceed lofty expectations. If it falls short of lofty expectations but still does wonderful things, it's going to come down in price. And reciprocally, stocks that have fallen way below their fundamentals, yeah, they're troubled. That's why they're cheap. But they have to underperform bleak expectations in order to hurt you. So with fundamental index, the view is these premium price stocks are wonderful. These deeply discounted stocks are troubled. Yeah, it's in the price. So what? So it won't hurt us to rebalance back to the fundamental economic footprint of the business. That gives you a stark value tilt, but it also gives you a rebalancing alpha because the price is always moving and the fundamentals move much slower. So you're always contra-trading against the market's most extreme bets.
So we're going to unpick a few of those and give some examples a little later on in this, but I just want to just put the spotlight on your firm, Research Affiliates. You are, I think, founded it in 2002 in Newport Beach, California. You're a global leader and smart beater in asset allocation dedicated to creating value for investors. Why did you feel the need to go and do this on your own?
Well, this was, depending how you count it, the third or the fourth asset management firm I'd built. And I'd built them for others, subsidiaries of larger companies, which is wonderful fun. But one thing I found was that if you're starting a business and it's part of another business, as soon as it gets big enough to matter in the grand scheme of things in the company's business, the lords in charge of that business start to take interest and start to introduce distractions. And so I realized, I was 47 at the time, I realized if I don't start a business myself, I never will. I actually had dinner with Jack Bogle as I was thinking about doing this, because he started Vanguard at age 47. And we had just a delightful dinner. And he said, Rob, don't be stupid, do it. And I was already probably going to do it anyway, but that don't be stupid, do it was kind of galvanizing.
Well, and that will set up for the nice little vignette later on in the passive versus active debate, but I'm going to hold on that. Let's just start a little bit macro. You've written quite a lot about inflation of late, and your expression was receding, not reversing. And I wonder, do you think you're radically different from consensus today on your inflation outlook?
Yes. The consensus is inflation is receding. It's not transitory. It's lingered longer than that. Not that there's a clear definition of transitory, but it's lingered longer than you could reasonably call transitory. But we're getting there. It's the last mile. And the Fed's on the job. They're going to finish this task of getting it back under control. We'll be back to 2% in due course. It's just taken a little longer than we like. The tagline, the last mile, to me, is another euphemism equivalent to transitory and just as flawed. So firstly, where does my view differ from consensus? I do not say that that consensus view is wrong. I say that that consensus view is at the benign end of a very wide range of potential outcomes, and that it's very dangerous to have that as your central expectation, because higher for longer is not at all unlikely. And so I was giving a talk 3-4 weeks ago, and I said to the audience, look, the break-even inflation rate, the difference between 10-year inflation-linked bonds and 10-year treasury bonds, 2.3%. So if inflation is 2.3, those two bonds will give you identically the same return. Okay, we all know that. We all understand that. Tacit implication is that risks are symmetric around 2.3. So let's say you undershoot by 1%. You come in at 1.3 for the next 10 years. Or you overshoot by 1%. You come in at 3.3 for the next 10 years. How many people in the audience think that 1.3 is more likely than 3.3? Almost no hands go up. How many think 3.3 is more likely than 1.3? The whole room hands go up. Typically, I've done this half dozen times. Typically, the answer is 95-5. So if the overwhelming majority thinks that overshooting is more likely than undershooting, that has investment implications. It means that even if the 2.3 absolutely could happen, could be the reality, that you're better off being in TIPS, inflation-linked bonds, than in treasuries because the risks are asymmetric. I love finding asymmetric risks because asymmetric risks create profit opportunities.
So before we continue this conversation, we're going to take a short break to have a note from our sponsors. The Money Maze podcast is sponsored by IFM Investors, a global institutional asset manager whose purpose is to invest, protect, and grow the long-term retirement savings of working people. Owned by pension funds and inspired by their members, they invest in what matters. As a responsible investor, IFM actively engages with their portfolio companies on issues they care about, with the aim of improving net performance whilst minimizing risk. They manage investments across infrastructure, debt, listed equities, and private equity assets. To learn more, tap the link in the episode description below. Now, we sit here a long way away looking at a series of rising deficits in a country that enjoys what Giscard d'Estaing once described as the exorbitant privilege of being able to fund in the world's de facto reserve currency, which of course we know it isn't. And yet it is extraordinary for those of us of a certain age that at a time of economic growth, one has had fiscal stimulus that is unimaginable. How does this end?
Our CEO, Chris Brightman, wrote a paper, The Current Path is Unsustainable, and he's got a follow-on paper coming out in the next few days, which looks at the linkage between the magnitude of spending and the magnitude of growth. Now, if the government boosts spending sharply this year, GDP will go up because GDP includes government spending. So massive government spending, you get a pop in GDP. GDP averaged over a 10-year span is correlated with lower annualized GDP growth, and the correlation is vast. It's a 60% correlation. So what that means is that this overspending has consequences. I would argue that the deficit isn't the problem, the spending is. Deficit spending has two components, deficit and spending. The spending's the problem because it siphons resources out of the private sector where resources are used efficiently. This relationship, the minus 60%, has a formula of GDP growth is about 4% minus about 6% times government spending. Rough numbers. You could infer from that that, gosh, if government spending was zero, you'd have 4% growth. No, that's stupid. Anarchy is not a good basis for growth. But once you get above, let's say, 20% of GDP, government's providing the services that are needed. You've got police, you've got fire, you've got roads, you've got defense industry, you've got all of the building blocks that are absolutely necessary. It's above that that you're going into discretionary spending that isn't necessary for a well-functioning economy. And that's where the costs are significant. Somewhere around 60 or 70% of GDP, and remember, parts of Europe are already at 50. 60 or 70% of GDP, the expected growth rate per capita, real growth, is zero. So you can spend your way to zero growth. The trade-off is very, very simple. Private sector is a little bit Darwinian. If you aren't working hard, you get sacked. If the company's not doing well, you can get sacked. If the company has stupid products, they won't prosper. Government if you're not working hard, they'll hire somebody else to work alongside you. And so government does necessary things, but does them very inefficiently. And that's the message in that research. So that's coming out very shortly, but it's exciting research because what it does is it puts a spotlight on the narrative. The Keynesian narrative is you spend more to stimulate growth. No, you spend more to stimulate a one-off pop in growth to cushion economic downturns. John Maynard Keynes would be evicted from almost any university and certainly any central bank board in the world today because he had this stupid idea that you can spend your way out of a recession, but then you run surpluses and pay it back. My goodness, why would you want to do that? So Keynes himself is not remotely Keynesian enough to be accepted in today's circles. And I think it's sad that the academic profession has become so enamored of hyper-Keynesianism, neo-Keynesianism, MMT, that it turns its back on all other disciplines. I gave a talk 10 years ago in Vienna and made an answer to one of the questions. I said, well, I'm kind of the Austrian school. And the person asking the question said, there are no Austrians left in the Austrian school in Austria. I thought that was hilarious, but sad.
So I want to just drill down because that deterioration has a price to be paid at some point. When you and I started in this business, the policeman was the long end of the bond market. The long end was emasculated by QE. There may be some QT right now, but one sense is the next big crisis and we're going to see more QE. How does this play out with where yields could go and where the dollar could also go, one up, one down, before serious repercussions ensue?
Well, a friend of mine, John Malden, coined the expression the bang moment. He said, when you're doing things that are stupid, that are reckless, things go along just fine until you hit the bang moment. And you think everything's fine, and then all of a sudden, yikes, bad stuff happens. And it happens with a rapidity that takes you by surprise. So I think the current trajectory of overspending is leading to a bang moment, but the bang moment could be a ways off. I mean, could it be in the coming 3 years? Yes. Could it take another 10 to 20 years? Yes. But what we're doing right now is unsustainable. Let me put it this way. The U.S. Treasury and the U.S. Fed and U.K. Treasury and the U.K. Central Bank and all of the other offices of government around the world, among other things, tries to predict where inflation's going, where unemployment's going, where interest rates are going, where GDP is going. Their batting average, their track record on forecasting is beyond abysmal. The U.S. Fed employs 400 PhD economists. Between them, Harvard and MIT employ 100. So they got four times as many PhD economists, and they can't forecast a damn thing. Now, do we really want to trust people who can't forecast a damn thing to manage those same damn things? The logic escapes me. So Australia's been called the lucky country. It's been called the lucky country because it went for 30 years without a recession. During most of that 30 years, with a brief exception of 2009, they ran a monetary policy where the yield curve was positively sloping for that whole span, and short end and long end of the yield curve were both offering positive real returns. That's a sensible monetary policy. They did not seem to show any interest in trying to micromanage, which is a big mistake. People talk about monetary policy having long and variable lags. That's another way of saying we have no clue if there's any relationship at all. Why not keep it simple? Interest rates are a reward for deferring consumption. Interest rates should be positive in real terms. You should have a reward for deferring consumption. That's where investment capital comes from. It should be positively sloping. Deferring consumption for 30 years should be worth more than deferring consumption for 30 days. So Australia had this positive real yield curve with a positive slope for almost all of the first 25 of those 30 years. And then it got religion, neo-Keynesian religion, and tried to micromanage. That's when they had their first recession in 30 years. So I think the correct monetary policy is keep it simple. What's the long end of the curve? That's managed by the market, by the bid and asks of millions of investors, and sets the long-term real cost of capital. Why not just keep the short rate 0.5% or 1% below the long rate and just use that as your guide? The Fed likes to say they're data dependent, but the data they depend on seems to change from one meeting to the next. It seems like they choose whatever data confirms what they want to do anyway. Why not use the one data point that is set by the market, long rates, as your most important data point, and say we'll just keep the short rate 0.5% or 1% below that? That would suggest a much lower rate than today. Slashing rates today would probably not be a good idea, but moving gently and gradually in that direction is probably harmless. Zero interest rates for a decade plus. Incredibly stupid. The real cost of capital should be a speed bump to discourage reckless spending. You have speed bumps, I guess, over this side of the water, you call them sleeping policemen. A speed bump discourages reckless driving. If you don't have a speed bump, there's going to be some people who drive recklessly. If interest rates inflict a cost, then you're not going to borrow recklessly. If you can borrow for nothing or for a negative real rate, you're going to borrow as much as you possibly can, which means that if you're highly rated enough, you're going to borrow to the hilt and spend. And that's done by corporations, by individuals, and by governments. A terrible pattern. And then on the fiscal side, the role of government deserves to be reexamined. What is government good at? Well, not much. What is it needed for? That's definitely several things. And so you need government. And then the question is, the things you don't need government for, can those be outsourced to the private sector? To the extent they can, you're going to be much wealthier for it.
So before we continue this conversation, we're going to take a short break to have a note from our sponsors. I'm thrilled to share that the Money Maze podcast is now sponsored by the World Gold Council. Gold has been at the foundation of human civilizations and economic history, from the pharaohs of ancient Egypt to James Bond. Through to its vital role in central bank reserves, gold has come to symbolize trade, culture, and currency. Discover the transformational powers of gold by watching Idris Elba's film on an adventure that explores gold's meaning and contribution to societies and economies the world over. Visit journey.gold on your browser to learn more. So let's go from the macro to the micro. Let's talk about valuations. We're talking about equity valuations, and we have these enormous dispersions going on both within markets and globally. Now, I want to just come back to an earlier point, because particularly for listeners around the world who, you know, who may be less familiar with the valuation disciplines that you adhere to and have, you know, developed, you made two points. Number one, value investing provides a persistent opportunity because agency constraints inhibit many investors from exploiting long horizon signals, and two, short horizon signals are often crowded trades. Can I ask you just to break each of those down in turn? Let's start with the first, the value investing opportunity.
Sure. In 2016, I wrote a paper, How Can Smart Beta Go Horribly Wrong? It was a wildly controversial paper. Some of our competitors bashed it with considerable glee and vigor. What I thought was funny was all that paper did was to say, well, let me back up. Suppose I'd written a paper that said, if you look at a stock and its price has soared, but its fundamentals haven't, then its past returns are going to look great. But that won't be something you can count on into the future. It gets worse than that. If there's any mean reversion, past positive returns could predict future negative returns. People would look at that paper and say, this guy's an idiot. Everybody knows that. To say exactly the same thing about factors and strategies became very controversial in the multi-factor investing community. And that's all I was saying. You get spreads in valuation, whether it's between high and low quality stocks, or between growth and value stocks, or between high beta and low beta stocks. When those spreads become unusually wide, you have an investment opportunity. Shift your emphasis towards the cheaper trade. And most of the time, that'll mean value. Sometimes it won't. Sometimes it'll say growth is pretty reasonably priced. That paper in 2016 showed that in 2007, value was trading at its smallest discount since the 1970s relative to growth, which tacitly would mean, you know, maybe value isn't in for a great run from here. And sure enough, it really wasn't. I wish I'd said that in 2007, but the research was done in 15 and 16. And what we find is that there are all of these circumstances, whether it comes to earnings or relative valuation or economic growth rates or almost anything in the macroeconomy, where there's long horizon mean reversion. When things get too good, watch out. They might soften. My boss back in the late 80s, one of my mentors, a guy named Bob Lovell, he had on his desk a plaque that said, "This too shall pass." And after I'd been working with him for 2-3 months, I was sitting down and chatting with him. And I said, what does that mean to you? He said, straightforward. If things are going great, this too shall pass. If things are going horribly wrong, this too shall pass. It keeps me grounded on mean reversion. And his kids let me have that plaque when he died, so it's on my desk.
Great.
But long horizon mean reversion is probably the most powerful profit engine in the capital markets.
And so the short horizon signals, often being crowded trades, I think allows me to then bring us right to the sort of the beating heart of AI exuberance and its trophy candidate, NVIDIA. Now, you have made the point, and I'm just going to quote it because it's an important point. You write, by the year end of 2017, zero of the top 10 stocks at the year end of 1999 had beaten the market over the subsequent 18 years. Top 10 tech stocks, yes, that's right. And we remember Cisco at 100 times earnings and all the rest of the great narratives. And you have quite rightly highlighted the narratives are often empty rhetoric. Tell me why the market is wrong about NVIDIA.
I wouldn't say narrative is empty rhetoric. I would say the narrative is usually largely correct, but it's already in the share price, so it's useless. Now, the narrative with Cisco in 2000 was this company produces the plumbing for the internet. It has high barriers to entry, tough to break in to compete with them, and it has growth as far as the eye can see. It has good margins that are only going to get better. That narrative was largely true. Second part of the narrative was these top 10 tech stocks are the beating heart of the internet, and they'll still be the dominant players in 10 years. Not as true. Third part of the narrative is this is going to happen fast. Well, the internet came on the scene fast, but its adoption by the citizenry was gradual. So going from 2000 to 2010, massive change. Going from 2000 to 2001 to 2002 to 2003, gradual. Those were the mistakes in the narrative. To me, the poster child for the dot-com bubble was not pets.com, everybody's favorite, but Qualcomm. Qualcomm was a wonderful company, still is, had the biggest gain of any stock in the world in the year 1999. It was up 2,700% in 1 year. It came into 2000 priced at 280 times earnings. And same narrative. These people produce the plumbing of the internet. They're going to have growth as far as the eye can see. How has the company done? Its profits last year were 60 times the profits of 1999. So the growth has been stupendous. Wow. that must mean it's been a great stock tone. No, if you owned Qualcomm in 24 years, you've made half as much money as in the S&P 500. Because the 280 multiple was, in the words of one wit back in 2000, was discounting not just the future, but the hereafter. We have some of the same thing happening with AI. Now, NVIDIA, as this year's poster child for AI, the narrative is AI is going to change everything. It's going to displace millions of highly skilled workers. It's going to create millions more jobs for those who know how to use it well. It's going to change the way we do research, change the way we write about things, the way we do art. It's going to change everything, and it's going to happen fast. And these are the dominant players, and they'll remain the dominant players. Most of that narrative is absolutely true. Wonderful companies doing brilliant things, and the barriers to entry are large. But with NVIDIA, you've got massive profits. And part of that is massive volume of sales, and part of that is a massive profit margin. So they have chips that'll sell for $40,000 a chip, for a little teeny chip, $40,000 a chip, and they're selling literally millions of them every quarter. All right, well, that's impressive. And they make over 50% profit margin on those, meaning that net of all cost of production, net of all R&D, net of all general and administrative expenses, net of all taxes, all of those expenses are less than half of their revenues. That's astonishing. So a natural question is, are Taiwan Semiconductor and Intel and AMD going to sit on their hands and say, you know, you guys are really good at this. Keep your 50% profit margin. Keep your 25, 30, 40% annualized growth expectations in the years ahead. It's okay. We'll let you have this. No, capitalist economies compete. And AMD in December came out with a chip that was 50% faster than NVIDIA's fastest. And it was priced at $13,000 instead of $40,000. So why didn't everybody buy that chip? Because you have to reprogram everything. Barriers to entry are significant, but the barriers to entry don't hold for 10 or 20 years. So over the coming decade, competitors will take significant market share and impose significant pricing discipline on that industry. We did a little back of the envelope. We said, what if in 2024, NVIDIA sales and profits double as expected relative to 23? Looks like they might even do a little better than that. But let's suppose they double. Then let's suppose that unit sales of superchips grow 25% a year for the next 10 years. Let's assume that the pricing goes to AMD's $13,000 by the end of the coming decade. Let's assume that NVIDIA's market share goes from 90-plus percent to 40%. What are its earnings in 2034 going to look like? They'll be less than 2024. So you can make pretty aggressive assumptions and paint very easy scenarios where NVIDIA's 2024 profits are their peak profits. I am not saying that that's my central expectation. My central expectation would be up and then softening. But I am saying that if you're paying 25 times sales for any stock, you need to be very worried about competition displacing the company. Palm made the ubiquitous Palm Pilot in 1999. Palm was spun off by 3Com in early 2000. It was spun off at a value that was larger than 3Com before the spinoff, meaning the rest of 3Com's business had a negative value. It was spun off at a valuation that fairly quickly, in a day or two, exceeded General Motors. And 2 years later, BlackBerry came on the scene, just demolished the Palm Pilot's basic raison d'etre. 5 years after that, the iPhone came on the scene and demolished BlackBerry's raison d'etre. So disruptors get disrupted. My suggestion is that NVIDIA is a wonderful company. that will probably still be doing wonderful things 10 years from now, but it's priced as if it's going to have dominant market share, vast profit margins, and stupendous growth without competitors devouring chunks of its market share.
Ronald, that's a beautifully described assessment. So thank you. So before we continue this conversation, we're going to take a short break to have a note from our sponsors. Schroders is a $950 billion public-private global asset management business. Built to deliver long-term client value, Schroders focuses their business on growing into areas where there is greater demand, private markets, bespoke solutions, and wealth management, and where they can better serve clients. Schroders take a long-term perspective and a leadership position in sustainability. With a 220-year history of successful adaptation and innovation, Schroders have always focused on serving clients. Remember, capital is at risk with investing. If we take those Magnificent Seven out, and first we'll just look at the rest of the market's valuation, and then let's pivot to the rest of the world. I'd like to break those into two chunks. How do you feel, firstly, about the US valuation opportunity ex those, first of all?
The Magnificent Seven, whoever coined that expression didn't see the movie. Four of the seven are dead at the end of the movie. So
I didn't actually know that.
Yeah. And it's now down to the Fabulous Four. So three have already stumbled. But if you take those Magnificent Seven and say, let's treat this as if it's an entire stock market of an entire country, what countries are bigger than the Magnificent Seven? The U.S., excluding Magnificent Seven, is bigger. They're 30% of the U.S. market. No other country in the world is bigger. The Magnificent Seven has a market value larger than all of China, larger than all of the EU collectively. Are these seven companies going to be a bigger source of future profits and growth and benefits to shareholders than the entire EU? I don't think so. I can't say categorically no, but that's in the price. So again, asymmetric risks. What's the likelihood that these seven are truly going to be a bigger engine for world growth than everything the EU's doing in the years ahead? Could happen, but that's a pretty aggressive assumption. That's in the price. So if they fall short of those lofty expectations, watch out. That's the nature of bubbles and crashes. It's not that the bubbles are built on a foundation of stupid thinking. It's that bubbles are built on a foundation of unreasonably aggressive pricing.
Back to the equation when you look at the rest of the market, and you know,
yes.
And I'd just like to unpick how your valuation work, you know, relative to the past sort of opines.
Well, right now we're testing the lows for value relative to growth that were achieved in summer of 2020. Summer of 2020, using FAMA French methodology, growth was 9 times the price of value. It's back to being 8 times the price of value again, and it's been more richly priced relative to value than that only summer of 2020 and peak of the dot-com bubble. The market is saying these companies are wonderful and will be a source of huge future profits for shareholders and huge growth. And these companies are, gosh, pretty darned uninteresting. Bricks and mortar, who needs it? Now, roll the clock forward 10 years. How big will AI be? Huge. That's in the price. Roll the clock forward that same 10 years and your loo needs fixing. Are you going to call AI or are you going to call a plumber? The bricks and mortar side of the economy will remain the dominant part of the economy for many years to come. AI is going to be hugely powerful. It'll threaten the jobs of everyone in this room. That's okay. That's the nature of progress. But case in point, we have a quarterly all-hands meeting. And first quarter of last year, I said to the group, everyone's hearing about AI. It's a big deal. It's going to change everything. But I want to reassure you, that not a single person in this room, not one of you, is at risk of losing your job to AI. You may be at risk of losing your job to somebody who knows how to use AI better than you do, so start studying. That's the nature of business. It evolves. So AI is going to be huge, but so is the rest of the economy, and it's priced as if it's being left for dead.
And is the disconnect that intrigues me that you've got that dispersion that for an investor should have many investors, I'm one of them licking their lips about the opportunity if you're a long-term investor about valuation. Here in the UK is a really good example because it's become so unloved. It's the classic, you know, if you're not allocating money in the UK, I don't think you're doing a job allocating. That's my own view. But whilst value companies have been derated, what does your work show you about their underlying performance?
The underlying performance of value companies has been fine. The narrative is you're going to get a higher yield, but slower growth. And a company by company, that's true. The growth companies grow faster, but a portfolio of value companies also has rotation. Companies that are cheap, some of them come back into favor and become more fully priced. They're kicked out of value and replaced with another deep value name. That means that every time value rebalances, you kick out a company with low earnings, low dividends for every $100 you're investing and replace it with one with higher. So you get a step up in earnings and dividends every time it rebalances. Growth does the opposite. A growth company falls out of favor. It's kicked out. It's replaced with a new frothy high flyer. So growth gets nice high growth rate and then every rebalance kicks some out and it ratchets back down. So here's a factoid that many of you in your audience will find shocking. If you look at Russell 1000 value and Russell 1000 growth, the growth rates this century to date for the dividends and earnings of a growth portfolio and a value portfolio have moved pari passu. They've been nearly identical. So the value side, you're getting just as good a growth rate as long as you're doing that rebalancing, just as good a growth rate as the growth portfolio, and you're getting a higher yield. So it's a great combination. And if there's any mean reversion, if you go from 1/8 the price of growth to the historic norm, which is 1/4 the price of growth, you just had value outperform growth by 10,000 basis points, 100 percentage points. That's a pretty good alpha.
And the downside of the value trap is that you will have those companies that are going down on their way to zero, often because they carry too much debt, but not always. There can be other factors. Do you worry about that? And if so, what do you do?
Well, I do and I don't. From an investment perspective, if I could filter out the value traps without filtering out the bargains, I would absolutely want to do so. From an optics perspective, we have active value strategies that do filter out potential value traps using quality filters, using momentum. I like to say that these help us eliminate 7 out of every 3 value traps. You're also losing some of the bargains. And in inefficient markets, small cap and emerging markets, these filters actually boost your return. You get better returns than you do with conventional value. In the more efficient markets, let's say MSCI World or Russell 1000, you don't get a higher return necessarily, but you get less outliers. And you definitely get less black eyes, less embarrassments. So we have a strategy with PIMCO called RAE that has been around for just under 20 years. Deep value strategy. It's beat the Russell 1000 value index by, I think the number's over 1.5% per annum for 20 years, net of all fees, net of all trading costs. That's pretty cool. And despite being deep value, how many value traps has it had? How many stocks have gone to zero? Zero. It's owned over 1,000 companies in the last 20 years, and it's had zero go bust. Well, that's pretty good. So yes, you can avoid value traps. You should ideally try to avoid value traps without losing too many of the true deep bargains. And that's hard. But avoiding value traps is not that difficult.
Got it. And we had Manny Roman, CEO of PIMCO, on the show earlier in the year in a very, very interesting interview. And so for those listeners who haven't, it's worth going back to. And before we leave this, almost none of the investment community, slight exaggeration, but predominantly on my travels and the investment committees where I, you know, where I'm involved, wants to allocate these days to emerging markets.
Right.
Just put through your lens, what do you see?
Emerging markets, tale of two cities. You've got the Alibaba, Baidu, and Tencent crowd, the frothy growth names. They're almost as expensive in China as the Mag 7 are here. Not as much as they were 2-3 years ago, but still, they're very expensive. So the spread between growth and value in emerging markets is as wide as it is in the U.S. It's huge. What that means is, look at value in emerging markets. Value in emerging markets, you can buy MSCI emerging markets value for a Shiller PE ratio of about 10. That's cool. You can buy RAFI, the fundamental index in emerging markets, for a Shiller PE ratio of about 8. You can buy half the world's GDP for 8 times earnings. Why on earth would you spend 34 times earnings to buy S&P if you could buy EM RAFI for 8 times? I look on that as one of the biggest opportunities today. The Achilles heel is U.S. stocks very expensive. If the U.S. has a bear market in the coming year or two, it's implausible that EM will shrug that off. So I would look to average in.
So we can't have a conversation about global stock investing without touching on the passive-active debate. I mean, passive, we all know the numbers, particularly in the U.S. I want to say, where does it end? But I guess my question really is, does it end?
Well, the short answer to that question is no, it doesn't end. The passive is here to stay. Passive will be a dominant player in the markets for the long horizon, foreseeable future. Passive's growth as a share of the market has to come to an end at some stage. And that could be in the coming 10 to 20 years, but could be a little quicker than that, probably not longer than that. Why does it have to come to an end? The whole raison d'etre for the capital markets is price discovery and efficient allocation of capital. Indexes don't do that. So we're working on a paper called Membership Has Its Privileges, stealing a tagline from Amex. And what we find is that the spread in valuation between index members and non-members has widened dramatically over the last 30 years. Membership has its privileges. If you're a member, you enjoyed that run-up in valuation. Membership has its privileges that you command a higher multiple. There was an episode a few weeks ago where S&P made a mistake, and I'm not faulting S&P. We all make mistakes. They made a mistake on a dividend index, accidentally including a stock that shouldn't have been included in one of their, they do data dumps of a file for index trackers to match the index. And the index trackers immediately added the stock. A week later, they found the error. They pulled it back out. The index trackers dropped it. The stock went from 84 to 91 to 84. So membership had its privileges in the form of a very minor index with very modest assets under management, causing a 9% rise in the price of a stock and a 9% drop. Membership has its privileges. Your company is worth more if it's a member of a major index. Now, if a company is worth more, its future IRR is lower because price is the other component of IRR. So, if all else is equal, if it doesn't change the growth trajectory of the business, membership means a higher price and a lower IRR. At some point, you reach a pressure point where the impact of lower returns for the members offsets the pricing pressure of higher short-term price movement. And at that point, the flood of active money into passive would likely be expected to stop. The other element here that I think bears mention is people say, why bother with active management? And active managers often say, yeah, but passive is just wrong. It doesn't do price discovery, et cetera, et cetera. It may be just wrong, but if it gives you better returns, you're going to go for it. So give people a superior alternative. That's difficult because the active management community owns much the same portfolio as the indexes. So if they own the same portfolio, they'll have the same return minus trading costs and minus fees. Gives them an assured lag. But if they can also operate in space where they're picking off mean reversion opportunities and they're picking off companies that aren't part of the major indexes, there's an opportunity to outperform. So I think at some point, people are going to realize active management has its role if we can identify active managers who have an edge.
If you were running a 60-40 today that was unconstrained, 60 equity, 40 fixed income, high level, you're not, as I say, you're not constrained by some of the market cap obligations or index obligations as percentages. What would be your high level weights today?
My high level weights would be heavily skewed towards stocks, just not the stocks that are heavily skewed in most people's portfolios.
And I need to push you on the fixed income weight and the 40% that's been the pension fund allocation for so long.
Emerging markets bonds are much more interesting than developed economy bonds, especially non-US developed economy bonds, where bond yields here in Europe and in Japan are just atrocious. And so there's the question, why bother? It doesn't mean bonds don't have a role. It just means be selective. Choose the bond markets that have respectable yield. Choose the stocks that have respectable valuations. And choose the markets that are out of favor, unloved, and therefore cheap. There's always a narrative for why not to buy what's cheap. That's why it's cheap. So you have to be able to shrug off those narratives. Now, how big a bet do you make? It depends on whether you're running your own money or somebody else's money. If you're running your own money and you don't look over your shoulder at how your next door neighbor's performing, make big bets. I do with my portfolio. If you're running somebody else's money, you have to assume that their risk tolerance is less than they think it is. And you want to make modest bets. So does that mean get out of the Magnificent Seven? No, it means underweight them.
Now, geopolitical turbulence is not new, but you'd have to say that it's about as unstable a world as many of us can recollect.
Gosh, why would you say that?
should one even care because of one's inability to affect outcomes as an allocator of assets?
As an allocator of assets, you should care for a very simple reason, and that is that heightened geopolitical uncertainty usually translates into heightened market volatility. Likewise, inflation that runs hotter for longer leads to heightened macroeconomic volatility and heightened market volatility. So I think the geopolitics, the chaotic U.S. political landscape, the Ukraine war, the Gaza war, the risks of China making moves on Taiwan, all of these things create an impetus for heightened volatility. I think it makes sense to make sure a good slug of your portfolio is invested for a margin of safety.
Got it. I'm going to ask you some rapid-fire closing questions. You can answer them in a word or a sentence. I'd like one word for this. What do you think of crypto?
One word.
I will allow you more than one.
I don't invest in anything that I don't understand. Therefore, I don't invest in crypto.
Trump or Biden, fiscally, is there any difference?
Not much.
Trump or Biden, politically, who is more unreliable?
Biden.
What makes for a good quant investor?
Awareness of non-quant issues. Don't go where the data leads you without having a prior hypothesis.
Who's the investment or business individual you'd most like to meet?
Oh, gosh.
I see any time you've paused all interviews to give me an answer.
Elon Musk. Never met him.
We've never interviewed him either. Maybe we could do something together on that. What is the way you relax?
I used to motorcycle until I had a tumble last September and realized that I'm probably getting too old and my reflexes aren't what they used to be. I collect wine. I collect travel memories. I collect friends. I have fun.
Have you had a particular mentor who's helped you on your journey?
The mentors who've been most meaningful to me are numerous. The most well-known of those mentors would be Peter Bernstein and Harry Markowitz. Both of them, absolute intellectual giants and absolutely wonderful human beings.
And final question, and then we will let you go. After that book, if you could just tell us one thing, what would be the one piece of advice for our listeners and viewers anywhere in the world?
Life is short and beautiful. Enjoy it.
Rob, thank you. I have made notes as we've gone along. As I go through this interview subsequently, I will be writing down a lot more things. So how can I possibly conclude lots of your great insights? For investors listening, the MSCI Value Emerging Market Indices are available at sub 10 times earnings.
Around 8 times earnings if you go with RAFI.
Right. And just help us again with RAFI is?
RAFI is the fundamental index.
It's your fund that you developed at Research.
So Schwab, Invesco, PIMCO, and other major platforms, if they have something that says fundamental index or RAFI, it's the fundamental index.
Got it.
And that in emerging markets is dirt cheap.
So we have value opportunity in all shapes and forms that is standing out for the long-term investors. We've been through an era where the real cost of capital has been absurdly cheap and caused large spread misallocations. And the consequences,
and
I think,
slowed growth, didn't speed it up.
And the consequences are now being seen. And, you know, the Magnificent Seven on their way to four might be on their way to even less. And let's look back for those who are maybe, you know, getting overexcited at 1999 and take some lessons from Qualcomm and Cisco and the rest. Well, it's been great to have you here today. Thank you very much for joining us.
This has been wonderful fun. Thank you. Really enjoyed it.